Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
I'm going to read this morning from Canto 3, Chapter 9. Focus on verses 5 and 6. This is entitled, Chapter 9 is Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy. Brahma's praying before Garbhadaksha and Vishnu. The previous chapter is describing, but the title of it is Manifestation of Brahma from Vishnu. A very similar description to what we find in Sri Brahma Samhita and in Canto 2 also. Canto 2, chapters 8 and 9. There are some details that are different. Right? It is not mentioned elsewhere. It's not like there's a contradiction or something. When we hear these descriptions, we should bear in mind that as our acharyas described, that there are different manifestations of Lord Brahma, as there are different universes. So there, as there are different Brahmas, there's different details. Here's one detail. In Canto 2, Chapter 9, Srimad Bhagavatam, it describes that when Lord Brahma, after his long, long penance, the whole of the spiritual world was manifested before him. And he was astonished, as one can imagine. And he entered before the personality of Godhead, who was surrounded by, it just gives numbers, the 10 and the 6 and the 16. In the purport, Prabhupada explained these are different potencies of the Supreme Lord that have different functions in the spiritual realm. There's the spiritual counterpart of everything we find here. Then the Lord stood as Brahma approached, and he extended his hand and shook his hand. And that's a rasa, a friendship. Whereas in Sri Brahma Samhita, specifically, it's described that Lord Brahma, described in the Brahma Samhita, had a relationship of madhurya. He understood his constitutional position as, first as an eternal servant of the Lord, then as an eternal maidservant of the Lord. So there are different Brahmas, there are different rasas, there's different details, and that's perfectly okay. No problem. The details in the third canto are of much greater detail than, of course, Brahma Samhita. It's a short work, so it's giving essences and not lots of detail. Second canto, more detail. Third canto, a lot more detail of the sequence of events before Brahma was born, and the nature of Brahma's appearance, and what Brahma did when he was born, the self-searching disposition of Brahma, how that was manifest, his climbing, he used his reasoning capacity. This is a lotus flower, and lotus flower must have a stem, and the stem comes from someplace. If I just go down the stem and down and down and down, I'll find where I came from. Very reasonable. He went down and down and down, and he found no end to the stem. And then he reasoned, I guess you can't find out that way. And then he heard, tapa, tapa. So he then prepared himself for that tapa.
Maharaj, is there actually any understanding of how big the lotus flower is, or Brahma is?
There's no measurement, but there's a discussion about, well, it's something that I've often pondered about, that is not besides length or, you know, the measurement. Where does matter begin and spirit end? Meaning, the Garbhadakshaya Vishnu was clearly a transcendental archivigraha. You know, Satchitananda vigraha. And then, okay, there's the lotus. That's part of his body, comes directly from his body. But everything comes, so there's it's coming up. There's both material and spiritual energy. So, is that stem spiritual and the flower spiritual? And Brahma has a body. The body is definitely material. It has a beginning and an end. But what about, you know, where is the... So matter is touching spirit. Is that stem... Literally, it has no beginning and end? As, you know, like spirit. Anyway, it doesn't give a dimension. How long is the stem? Long enough that he couldn't find the end to it. So he went back to the top of the lotus, did his tapa, and saw the form of the Lord. The form of the Lord is described. Very, very beautiful. The Lord showed his lotus feet by raising them. His lotus feet are the source of all awards achieved by devotional service free from material contamination. Such awards are for those who worship him in pure devotion. So, details of the description, his lips, his nose, his eyebrows, his belt, his waist. Like a great mountain, the Lord stands as the abode of all moving and non-moving living entities. He is the friend of the snakes because Lord Ananta is his friend. As a mountain has thousands of golden peaks, so the Lord was seen with the thousands of golden helmeted hoods of Ananta Naga. And as a mountain is sometimes filled with jewels, so also his transcendental body was fully decorated with valuable jewels. As a mountain is sometimes submerged in the ocean water, so the Lord is sometimes submerged in the water of devastation. Lord Brahma, thus looking upon the Lord in the shape of a mountain, concluded that he was Hari, the personality of Godhead. He saw that the garland of flowers on his chest glorified him with Vedic wisdom and sweet songs, a singing garland. I'm not Vishnu. And looked very beautiful. He was protected by the Sudarshan wheel for fighting, and even the sun, moon, air, fire, etc. could not have access to him. When Lord Brahma, the maker of the universal devastation, thus saw the Lord, he simultaneously glanced over the creation. Lord Brahma saw the lake in Lord Vishnu's navel and the lotus flower, as well as the devastating water the drying air and the sky all became visible to him. Lord Brahma, thus being surcharged with the mode of passion, became inclined to create. And after seeing the five causes of creation indicated by the personality of Godhead, five primary elements, he began to offer his respectful prayers on the path of the creative mentality. That's the end of chapter 8, where Brahma has appeared from Lord Vishnu. With his inquisitiveness, he came to understand what is his source, he came to understand who he was, he came to understand the purpose for his being created, to make the creation happen. He's yet to receive the full plan, like the blueprint, the impression of what a universe is supposed to look like. So now he's, in the beginning of chapter 9, he's praying to the Supreme Lord for creative energy. Now the last verse of this chapter 8 says he already has it. So the consciousness that he's in is how to properly utilize it. I find it very valuable not only to get some insight into Lord Brahma's disposition, his realization, those kinds of things, but also it's very instructive for us when we have something, we undertake some task. His is a little bigger than what we would do. You know, I have to create a universe. He's endowed with that potency, Srishti Shakti. It's the potency to create a universe, and the intelligence to do it, and everything. So we may have the ability to walk across the floor, or do something. So how do we begin undertaking that something that we're endowed with some ability to do? What should be the mood and the consciousness and the regard in our relationship with Krishna? So listen with that ear, as well as how what Brahma did.
Last night you talked about we can see when the light is present. And so it seems Brahma suddenly was able to see.
Yeah.
Is it just a matter of Krishna revealing
himself?
It's not.
Yes.
Just Brahma didn't do anything.
No. Okay. He was both Second Canto and Sri Brahma Samhita describe not only he was the only person, but it was complete darkness. I mean, wake up in the morning and it's complete darkness. And your first thing you wonder is, who am I? I don't think, where am I? Where's the light switch? But there was nothing. There was nobody to ask. So self-searching. And then the Lord appeared. Down the stem, up the stem, tapa. The Lord revealed. So he pulled back the curtain and there he was. Lord Brahma said, "Oh my Lord, today," of course Brahma's days are pretty long, "today, after many, many years of penance, I have come to know about you. Oh, how unfortunate the embodied living entities are. that they aren't able to know your personality. Note that there aren't any embodied personalities yet. And note that he's in this, ecstatic state. And he's thinking about other living entities and the welfare of other living entities. Tell something about his stature. My Lord, you're the only knowable object because there's nothing supreme beyond you. Whatever there is to be known, it's from you. And you're that source, and so you're really the only knowable object. And know you, and you know everything. One who knows you knows everything. And everything is from you. Knows everything, not in the sense of minutiae, but knows the purpose of everything, function of everything, relationship of everything with the Supreme. If there's anything supposedly superior to you, it is not the Absolute. You exist as the Supreme by exhibiting your creative energy of matter. He gets an A on that one because in the second canto, when Lord Vishnu arose and received him, he said, "You pleased me very much by your penance. Now you please ask for some benediction. I'd like to give some benediction." So Brahma is very intelligent. He asked for two. He asked for a series of questions, and then the Lord answered them. And then he asked for protection from the false ego tendency to think that I'm doing the creating. That was good. And he's doing the same thing here. He has this creative impetus. He sees all the elements, as that was described previously. Although it's just, before they're, it's just like a big warehouse. It's just the elements. It's not in any shape or anything like that. It's just elements. So he's acknowledging these are your creative potencies, the elements. They come from you. They exist because you expanded them. And I exist because you expanded me, and my impetus to create the universe with these elements, that's from you also. Like, you get all the credit. And I'm an instrument. That's the starting point, whether it's walking across the room or something more sophisticated, whatever it is. The capacity comes from the Supreme Lord, and we acknowledge, as Brahma is doing here, that's protection. And it's devotion. Then there's this issue of the spiritual and then the material coming from the spiritual, which can be confusing if you don't have, you're not loved them on. But how does something material come from something spiritual? If you're my body, you say, it doesn't. This is false. It isn't. That's how they deal with it. Well, here's how Brahma deals with it. The form which I see is eternally freed from material contamination and has advented to show mercy to the devotees as a manifestation of internal potency. This incarnation is the origin of many other incarnations, and I am born from the lotus flower grown from your navel home. The many incarnations include, just quickly scanning the purport, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. And so this is Lord Vishnu, and Lord Vishnu himself is an expansion of Krishna, and from Lord Vishnu, Brahma and Shiva come. So that for the purpose of creation and annihilation, of the universe, which Lord Vishnu is the maintainer. And then different incarnations appear within that creation of the Lord by his energy. And so there's, Prabhupada once said it very simply, there are two things, Krishna and Krishnas, and there's not a third thing. Cool. The incarnations of Vishnu, who appear at different ages and times, are never to be compared to the conditioned souls. Anyway, so Prabhupada is smashing impersonalism, because impersonalism says there isn't. In fact, even the idea of Atma, it's Brahman. And Paramatma, it's really Brahman. It's get a whitewash and put it through a blender and it's all Brahman. It's all one. But never to be compared. It was an offender, Pashandi, with things like that. Text 3, O my Lord, I do not see a form superior to your present form of eternal bliss and knowledge. In your impersonal Brahman effulgence, in the spiritual sky, there is no occasional change and no deterioration of internal potency. I surrender unto you because, whereas I am proud of my material body and senses, your lordship is the cause of this, of the cosmic manifestation, and yet you are untouched by matter. He's describing the difference between the Lord and living entity, between the internal potency and the external potency, between things that are not created and are eternal, and things that are created and are temporary. It's Sankhya. And acknowledging his position as dependent. It's something like an expansion of the first of the Chaturshloki verses of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna is speaking, saying, Aham sarvasya prabhavo matak sarvam pravartate. I'm the source of everything, everything comes from me. Iti madva, thus knowing, vajante mam. Engage in my service. Go to lotus, engage in my devotional service. So Brahma is saying, you're the source of everything. And the nature of that source of everything is, like Krishna describes the souls, unborn, undying, unchanging, unmutable, ever-existing. You and the whole spiritual sky and the spiritual atmosphere, eternal, different rules governing it. It's not temporary, it's not coming and going. It's ever the same, with full diversity at the same time. And you're the source of both. You're the source of my body, you're the source of me, you're the source of my ability, you're the source of the energies of creation, you're the source of the creation. You're the source of everything. And I have some service for you. But he's praying for the capacity to do his service properly. So, you have to walk across the floor or do whatever it is that we do in our devotional service, pray to Krishna for the capacity. And even we may know. We have the capacity. Acknowledge where the capacity came from. Don't blink your eyelid or digest your food or do anything. That's the mood of a devotee. The present form, or any of the transcendental forms expanded by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, is equally auspicious for all the universes, since you have manifested this eternal personal form upon whom your devotees meditate. I therefore offer my respectful obeisances unto you, those who are destined to be dispatched to the path of hell. Neglect your personal form because of speculating on material topics, which were all too familiar. But now, I've spoken on those verses before, so I wanted to cover 5 and 6. So that's just context. Now 5 and 6, I'll read the verse in purport. O my Lord, persons who smell the aroma of your lotus feet, carried by the air of Vedic sound through the holes of the ears, accept your devotional service. For them you are never separated from their, from the lotus of their hearts. Did you catch that?
Yeah.
During the Japa retreat that we just had, I just participated in Kita Nagri. I'll just share one of the lessons, like a capsule version of one of the tools for the devotees in the Japa retreat. And it goes something like this. We regard things differently when we see that they have some value than things that we don't see have any value. Common sense. So, give examples. Sanatana Goswami, the touchstone which was in the garbage, and he gave the holy name to the Brahmana that wanted charity from Sanatana Goswami. Or Maharaj Ambarish, who had wealth not equal to, but surpassing the wealth of heaven. And he saw it as no more meaningful than a stone in the street. He used it in service as a king to give care to his citizens. But he didn't care for it. He cared for his worship of Krishna. But part of the worship of Krishna was a service, and therefore there was meaning to it. But in and of itself is a zero. Put a one in front of it, okay, it's got it, it's ten. But I'm separate from Krishna. So his value was with Sabhaimana Krishna Padara Vinayo. That was Marjambaraj. So on that basis, understanding the glories of the holy name or the glories of devotional service to Krishna as a way of life, or the glories of Krishna or the glories of anything of the spiritual realm, to hear the sambandha again, that the nature of those things and the distinction of those things from material things helps us to have the value. Because otherwise we can chant mechanically for a long time. Unless our consciousness goes there while chanting, it's not going to have the same effect. It's inattentive chanting. Chanting, but inattentive chanting. Making some sound, and it's not the full effect, it's not going to be experienced by us. So, hearing, as Lord Brahma is doing, hearing a description or offering a description of the glories of this wonderful form as a very intelligent being, Lord Brahma can see. So, is what he's doing. So one of the messages in this Japa retreat was this: there's a difference between material sound and spiritual sound. So there's sacred sound. Without all the things that what material sound isn't, that spiritual sound is, spiritual sound is called in the Vedas Shabda. And Shabda conveys not only the idea of a thing, but the thing. The fullness of spiritual reality is within Shabda. Like, let's say, take two material things. Chair. That's a sound that indicates the thing. And the sound that indicates the thing is different than the thing. But the name of Krishna and Krishna, there's no difference. Abhinatam nama namino. And with Krishna, Krishna's never alone, Krishna's with his whole entourage. And his abode, and his devotees, and all the paraphernalia, and it's all there in that sound vibration. So let's say, then another material example, let's say a broadcasting an image, a television broadcast. So here's the studio, here's the camera. The camera sends a signal, and it goes over there, and somebody sees it on the television set. But there's the reproduction of what's going on in the studio. Live. But the image on the screen gives an indicator. It's there's no substance. It shows something that supposedly is of substance. But Shabda, the substance is there in all detail, which is what is being said here. Persons who smell the aroma of your lotus feet carried by the air of Vedic sound through the holes of the ear. So there's his lotus feet. There's the aroma of his lotus feet. There's the particles of dust around the aromatic lotus feet. And all of that is within that sound, carried by the sound, or non-different than the sound vibration. The whole of the spiritual reality is conveyed through Vedic sound. And those that receive that, they go, ooh, devotional service. For them, you are never separated from their hearts. Nice verse. Purport. For the pure devotee of the Lord, there is nothing beyond the lotus feet of the Lord. And the Lord knows that such devotees do not wish anything more than that. Intimacy of love. Just through sound. It's mystical. Or how do you explain such a thing? It's nirvachaniya. How do you give words to such an experience? You can describe, well, it's like this, or it's like that, it's like that. But you won't know what it is until you experience it. The experience is accessible just through sound. Get your receivers tuned up. And hear very carefully. Receive, because the whole spiritual reality is there. And once that touches your heart, it awakens love, appreciation, great appreciation. And with that, the reciprocation. So the beginning part is proper broadcaster, turn on your receiver, clean up the receiver, get it refined. And progressively, the heart moves, and as the heart moves, Krishna reciprocates. Up to the fullness of what's being experienced by Lord Brahma. And then he's saying, how unfortunate it is for people that don't have this. That's his first thought. Like for us, like any elevated personality, how unfortunate are the persons that don't have this. I wish them to have this.
Raj.
Yeah.
If I say the word cinnamon, you can somehow smell cinnamon right now. If you think about it, that's but I've never, at least in conscious memory, don't know what the lotus feet of Vishnu are. So how is it that I...
By factual contact. It's what we have forgotten. Bhaktivinoda Thakur's phrase is svatak siddha jnana, which means knowledge that's inherently within. When Prabhupada, I was told this as a very new devotee, it was a long version is really charming, but a short version, minus all that charm, is the first time Prabhupada spoke publicly, Tompkins Square Park, in America, when they had kirtan, 2 hours, devotees dancing, the crowd memorized, what is this? And then Prabhupada stood up, that pose, in front of the, underneath the oak tree with a big church in the background, and looking very serene, and everyone wondering, what's he going to say? He said, I've not come to teach you something new. I've come to remind you of that which you have forgotten. So, not to our conscious memory, as you said, but it's there. Just as Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sadhya Kavana. Krishna Prema is within the heart. And certain knowledge of Krishna is there in the heart. Not to our conscious memory, but it's there and it's awakened. By contact with fire, the fire that's in the wood comes out. It's already there. It looks pretty innocent. It's like there's a cabinet. But there's fire. In a storage state. And the fire comes out by contact with fire. So by contact with Shabda, that awareness comes out. It's something like what you asked previously. Did Brahma have to do something? The Lord revealed. Brahma prepared his heart. He took the instruction that the Lord gave, which was for his purification. And when he was purified from the Lord's side, Brahma didn't have to say, okay, I'm ready now. The Lord just showed himself. So now he's seeing him and he's experiencing from a platform of conscious awareness of that which he had forgotten. It's already there. Knowledge is not... Okay, else. The word T-U, two, is specifically establishes this fact. That the Lord... Where is this? But... The Lord does not wish to be separated from the lotus hearts of those pure devotees. That is the transcendental relationship between the pure devotees and the personality of Godhead. Because the Lord does not wish to separate himself from the hearts of such pure devotees, it is understood that they are specifically dearer than the impersonalists. The relationship of the pure devotees with the Lord develops because of devotional service to the Lord on the authentic basis of Vedic authority. Such pure devotees are not mundane sentimentalists, but are factually realists because their activities are supported by the Vedic authorities who have given oral reception to the facts mentioned in the Vedic literatures. So their qualification is oral reception. And the means of elevation is the sound and the mercy of the broadcasters of those sounds. And the qualification of the broadcasters of those sounds. And then it takes place. Like Prabhupada says, pregnancy requires the fertile mother and the potent father, and the two combine, and then there's pregnancy. So that it has to be like the first canto, the qualified hearer, the qualified speaker. And there's detailed, repeated detailed descriptions of what are the qualifications of the receiver, what are the qualifications of the broadcaster for the transmission of transcendental sound, the reception of transcendental sound, and then self-realization, God-realization, the awakening of our dormant spiritual consciousness. The internal potency is powerful. It's effective. It works. Brahma is experiencing, he's making the contrasting difference between the external potency and the internal potency. And he's appreciating how wonderful is the internal potency. And how bewildering is the influence of the external potency. The word parya in this verse is very significant. Para bhakti, or spontaneous love of God, is the basis of an intimate relationship with the Lord. Previous paragraph is the intimate relationship. The Lord can't think of anything but the devotee. The devotee can't think of anything but the Lord. They're packed up together. The Lord is in their heart, and he doesn't want to be anywhere else. And the devotee is with the Lord, and they don't want to be anywhere else. There's nothing. What's the basis of that? Spontaneous love. Parabhakti is the basis of an intimate relationship with the Lord. The highest stage of relationship with the Lord can be attained simply by hearing about Him. His name, form, quality, etc. From authentic sources, like Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, recited by pure, unalloyed devotees of the Lord. And text 6. Oh my Lord, the people of the world are embarrassed by all material anxieties. They're always afraid. They always try to protect wealth, body, and friends. And they're filled with lamentation and unlawful desires and paraphernalia. And they avariciously base their undertakings on the perishable conceptions of my and mine. As long as they do not take shelter of your safe lotus feet, they are full of such anxieties. And Prabhupada spends the time in the purport discussing those anxieties and the fruitive mentality, as we were discussing yesterday evening. The first is that due to lack of contact with the internal potency, being spirit soul of the nature of one who's happy, seeking happiness and fruitive activity. And what a great misfortune, Brahma is saying, similar to what, no surprise, but Narada was saying to King Pujinibhati. What a great misfortune. And the great misfortune is they're not in touch with the lotus feet of the Lord, and because that's the position of real happiness. Instead, it's the pursuit of something perishable and consciousness covering. What a great misfortune. Now, this is a person that's about to create a universe. So it's you know, he's not a small timer. He's very, very capable. And he will do it. But with a very, very different sense of simply for service to the Lord. Again, he has impetus. This comes in the at the end, in the Sri Brahma Samhita, at the end of Brahma's prayers, he does his tapa, he gets his realization, he recites these wonderful prayers that we recite over and over again. They're so beautiful. And when that's over, he expresses a doubt. And his doubt is, I want to create a universe. I have these nice realizations, and you gave me this impetus to create a universe. I want to create a universe, and I'm concerned, I'm apprehensive, that in the course of creating the universe, I'm going to get covered over and entangled in the soup. So, what to do? And this is, it's very instructive, very practical message for all of us. Lord Vishnu says to Lord Brahma, by joining the activities of bhakti, sadhana bhakti, practicing, you know, the principal activities of bhakti, joining them with the activities of our impetuses for material activity, we're protected. The potency is there for protection. The potency, but the protection is, you do those things for Krishna. Bhaktisiddhanta uses the word dovetail. In course of time, the dovetail becomes one thing. It's not just I join something I like to do with something that is conveniently is offerable to Krishna. But in the mature stage, there's only one thing, and that's what Krishna wants. It doesn't matter. I want, don't want, what's my nature, and all those things. My impetuses. It's just whatever Krishna wants. And that's the platform of service. The platform of service is whatever Krishna wants. So the impetus for Brahma to create is because Krishna wants. That's where he got the impetus from. So it's his impetus, but the false ego can so easily cover that. It wants protection from that. It doesn't want to fall prey to the deluding potency. So staying in the internal potency is assisted by very careful things that's right here, hearing and chanting. So I'll just read the paragraph. There's two paragraphs, but the second paragraph deals with this, specific with monetary. That's something that people are involved with, householders particularly. Paragraph. A pure devotee of the Lord never thinks of himself as the proprietor of his home. He surrenders everything under the supreme control of the Lord, and thus has no fear for maintaining his family or protecting the interests of his family. Because of this surrender, he no longer has any attraction for wealth. Even if there is attraction for wealth, it is not for sense enjoyment, but for the service of the Lord. A pure devotee may be attracted to accumulating wealth just like an ordinary man, but the difference is that the devotee acquires money for the service of the Lord, whereas the ordinary man acquires money for his sense enjoyment. Thus, the acquisition of wealth by a devotee is not a source of anxieties, as is the case for a worldly man. And because a pure devotee accepts everything in the sense of serving the Lord, poisonous teeth of accumulation of wealth are extracted. If a snake has its poison removed and bites a man, there is no fatal effect. Similarly, wealth accumulated in the cause of the Lord has no poisonous teeth, and the effect is not fatal. A pure devotee is never entangled in material worldly affairs, even though he may remain in the world like an ordinary man. But these are really practical, valuable instructions about how to conduct our affairs of life while moving on the path of devotion to Krishna. The teaching is not a secular one. Secular means there's something, I do so much for God and so much for me. Called the two-pocket program. Like a mantra. Krishna, Krishna, me, 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 Krishna, Krishna. The devotional program is one-pocket program. It's Krishna, 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 hey. That's the devotional program. And cultivating that, even I may not be there, without envy of Krishna's position or any hesitation about acknowledging Krishna's position, I may not be there. And let me cultivate that. And that's also under the umbrella of Rupa Goswami's teachings. One who is cultivating anushilana, the anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma adhyanavritam, that principle of distancing oneself, detaching oneself from fruitive activity and mental speculation. That's uttam bhakti, even in the practicing stage, the cultivating stage. Because it will take you there. There's many, so many just valuable lessons, practical lessons on how to undertake activity, but just one other very big area is how we view how things come into being has a very profound effect on how we view what we do every day. It may seem like, okay, that's interesting philosophy, and then there's my life. And like, abstract. It really doesn't matter, because it's just philosophy anyways. And how can you know and prove it anyways? But you take that spirit, and there's different ideas, minus a theistic idea, minus a scientific theistic idea, there's the pressure of other ideas. Real prominent ones. Where does everything come from? It comes from nothing. It comes from Big Bang. It comes from chemical evolution. It comes from so many things. Even if somebody's not thoughtful, which most people aren't thoughtful, even if somebody's not thoughtful, if you're in a mindless state, you're just at a conveyor belt, like Prabhupada speaks of an animal that's being sent to the slaughterhouse, or like this example yesterday evening, Narada speaking to the king, there is the deer. There's the she deer and the beautiful garden and hummingbirds and bees and fragrant scents and, you know, utopia. And in front is the tiger. And he's oblivious because he's too much in the enjoying spirit. So if we're mindless, we're on the conveyor belt of time is ticking and we're just captured in the cycle of mindless activity of birth and death, that whole description that we gave yesterday of bodies do things with the senses, impression is stored in the mind, the body gets old and poops out, and you go to another body, and then the impetus is for other activities, and just the whole thing, it's endless. An endless condition of mindlessness, if you're just, the mind is shut off. And then there's all these other people that saying it comes from just laws of nature. I mean, prevalent, very prevalent, is respect for people towards science, because science is providing us with so many things, so it's science, yay. And what is modern mechanistic science says, there's only one thing, and that's matter and the laws that govern matter. Hearing Giriraj Maharshi explaining to Prabhupada in a morning walk in Juhu, that Prabhupada, I went to a conference and the man was saying that all there is matter and the laws governing matter. And Then when I asked him, where does matter come from? He said, that I do not know, but I know that we don't have to rely on God to say where matter comes from. So that's the picture. And if that's the picture, then what are the laws governing life? And so we can be mindless, it doesn't matter. Just row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. It doesn't matter. But if you have something that matters, then it's godlessness, and where is it taking you? I made a presentation at the University of Houston and to the Indian Graduate Student Association, IGSA. So there's like all these master's and PhD graduate students attending a little amphitheater, and the presentation was Sadaputta's Mysteries of the Sacred Universe. Had the DVD and went through the whole thing. And I'd become quite familiar with it, so you know, the audience could capture what I was saying. The language wasn't so too complicated, they caught it. And at the beginning, the introduction was some people laughed, because they were mostly Indians, to the Indian Graduate Student Association. Many people laugh, Western people laugh at the Vedic cosmology, because Vedic cosmology is geocentric. And Copernicus said, that's rubbish, it's heliocentric. So people from that perspective looked at Vedic anything and say, rubbish. But here's a picture that is from Copernicus's time, when he said heliocentric, he gave a dimension of the sun and the distance between the sun and the earth. And it was off by a factor of 150. And then telescopes got better and got closer and closer. And now it's practically a one-to-one correlation between what they had in Vedic times as the size of the sun and the distance. But just take that one dimension of cosmology. And very, very, very sophisticated things, and they didn't have any technology. And now that they mount a Hubble telescope on a rocket thing and send it out in space and zoom, zoom, take pictures, send the pictures back, and analyze them, and now they're getting closer and closer, but they didn't have any technology. So where do they get their wisdom on quantifiable empiric things? It's amazing. And in this amazing picture, it says that the source of everything is a person. So think about the value of how that impacts your life. If the source of everything is a person, or the source of everything is nothing, it has profound impact on how you view the world. So at the end, one of the students raised his hand and said, in theoretical physics, they have calculated down to a few milliseconds what happened from the Big Bang, but they can't go further back. And I said, okay. Then another one raised his hand and said that the picture of Big Bang is, besides what happened a few milliseconds before, here there are two models. One that says, as the universe expands and expands and expands and expands and expands, because of the laws of gravitation generating from mass, it will continue to expand up to some point in time, and then it'll just dissipate into nothingness. And the other is, it will implode upon itself. It'll come back and back to the, you know, whatever existed before the Big Bang, singularity. And that's very interesting. Just see what you just described. Besides what happened a few milliseconds before, so it's an interesting theory. In the beginning, there's nothing. And in the end, there's two varieties of nothing. So, what's in between? You see? It has an impact on how you view cosmology, has an impact on how you view life. what you value is you regard things that you value more than things that you don't value. So where have I come from? Where does this thing come from? It has a profound effect, an impact on how we experience life day by day. And so that was for the scientist, and for us, being able to connect, as Brahma is doing very clearly, besides his intelligence, he's connecting his heart to the personality of Godhead. And because of that, he's experiencing things. And he's explaining those things that he's experiencing, and he's going to do some service that's desired by the Lord and for the benefit of the living entity. And gee, it would be nice to be in that consciousness and not be attached, this concept, last little section, attached to I and mine. Like, that's the fruit of our work. I do this, I'm the cause of the fruit of my work. But Krishna advises in very simple language in Bhagavad Gita, never consider yourself to be the cause of action, the cause of the results of action, nor inducing others to act, because all that is being carried out by Prakriti. And that's a God-conscious concept, and the other is not. And the result, the quality of one's life, that is a God-conscious conception, is altogether a different quality of life. Although one may be doing the same thing, like this example here, money. And that's something that you have some interaction with, all of us. Have some interaction. And how do we regard it? It's a facility for sense gratification. You could say, oh, I'm taking care of my family. It's a facility of sense gratification. Or it's a resource that has come from God and you're using in His service. And so you can be very enthusiastic to work strongly in your occupation, your careers, whatever. And something comes and you use that in Krishna's service. And then that is the detachment from the entanglement of material energy that covers the consciousness of the soul, which is who we are and our relationship with God and the internal potency. So it's not a small thing. It's not optional. I'll just put that one on the side and go on with life. It's critical how we view that which comes to our hand, and our intelligence, our ability, our strength, our capacity, whatever it is that we have, the asset which God has given us, how do we view it? Where does it come from? What's its purpose? You know, what's my purpose? That was Brahma's question. He had an emphasis to create. He knew it. And he knew, so now he's knowing where it came from. He's acknowledging it and seeking protection from the misuse of that, or seeking guidance for the proper use of that. We should too. Okay, any discussion?
Earlier in the discussion you said that matter comes from spirit, right? And then we need to understand...
Sarvam kalvidam brahma. Right? Everything, you know that one. Yeah, there you go. Everything comes from the Supreme.
Yes.
Aham sarvasya prabhavo. Matak sarvam pravartate. Everything. Includes matter.
But my question is, we living entities are also spirit, and God has created matter. So my question is, God is superior to both matter and spirit.
Yeah, they're energies and He's any energetic.
So this spirit, which is is somehow different from the Supreme Spirit and is not able to produce matter.
Right.
So
we're an energy we're both spirit in the sense of quality, but not capacity. It's not because we're spirit, we have the capacity to generate matter, because he's the supreme spirit, he can generate all matter, so we should be able to generate some. Not like that. We're Prakriti, and he's Purusha. He's the possessor of Prakriti. In that sense, we're conscious. We Satchitananda. Matter is not conscious. Asat, Achit, and Nirananda. This different kind of energy. Energy and energy. And energetic. And the energetic produces the energy. Not the energy produces energy. The energetic produces energy, and therefore it's his. Purusha, it belongs to him.
This concept, I mean, took a long way to think.
It's a very interesting question, though.
It was in 15th chapter also, Lord says towards the end, like, and beyond the, beyond both the spirit and matter, right?
Yeah. As in the as the energetic, he is beyond. He's not influenced by, whereas we are influenced by. We are spirit, but we're influenced by. And he's spirit, but not influenced by, because he's the energetic. It's his energy. He's not under the influence of his energy. In that sense, love. Pretty creative question. Congratulations. Something's still rattling around there?
Yeah, I mean, when the question comes to the creation, you talked about the Big Bang theory. You know, I heard that there is a Big Bounce theory coming up, which says that it matter comes back and goes back again.
Yeah.
So it's a cycle rather than...
Sure. That when at this Indian Graduate Student Association, when this person said there are these two, I commented, you may know the name, a Harvard professor who had a TV show, and he also, I saw a clip of that show where he said there are these two models, and he likes the cycle one. Which is, he acknowledged, this is a Vedic concept. Mm-hmm. Expand and flow, resting for some time. Expand and flow, resting for some time. And cycles, because he said, you know, that's how things work in cycles. So the cosmos should also work in cycles. Like the concept. So, you know, becoming a popular concept, that's nice. It's still the question, so where does it begin? Where does the cycle come from? And then they'll say, this didn't come from anything. It just is. That's primordial. That's God, in other words. There's matter, and the laws that govern matter, and there's nothing else. There's only matter, and laws that... So that matter moves like this, goes out and comes back and rests for some time. That's it. Don't ask, you know, the silly question, where does it come from or why? It's just, that's God. That's all there is. Everything comes from that. That's their religion.
That degrees the common sense, because we see that.
Sure.
Everything comes from something.
Yes. Well then, This, I've been listening to Prabhupada's morning walk conversations, it's listed alphabetically, so it starts in Bombay, and like a zillion in Bombay, and then goes to other places. Alphabetically, Durban. So, in Los Angeles, I'm listening to those now. Every morning walk, it's like he's hammering it with the scientist and Shruti Dhanadhar. So he's saying, Prabhupada is saying, when does it begin? It's everything had, just as you said. And then it was, you know, said, everyone was silent. They said, and they will say, where does God come from? If you, you know, we say everything starts with matter, you say everything starts with God, where does God come from? Then he went and said, so here's a dispute, who's going to settle? Then repeated it, you know, again, twice. They say, we say, who's going to settle? He was asking the devotees to, you know, supply an answer. And the answer that was that he accepted was scripture or Shabda. Shabda Pramana. That's the authority. Of course, they don't accept Shabda. So they're not going to accept the decision. They don't accept. Okay. They're relentless. But that's where the settlement comes. That's the ultimate authority for things that you wish to know. That's the pramana. Shabda the pramana.
Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita is there. I mean, the argument is, it's a book. Somebody wrote it. So it has to be a human being who wrote it. I mean, it's hard to conceive that it has come from spiritual world or something. I mean, it is authoritative. Or the person, even if it is a human being, he was connected to God and then he wrote it, kind of thing. I mean, it's hard to make it authentic unless it is a leap of faith.
Well, two things. Faith is intrinsic to the soul. We can't function without faith. We can't breathe or walk across the floor or function without faith. There's faith. It's intrinsic. We can't give faith a bad name because it's something that's inseparable from the living entity. Like the divisions of faith, people don't have faith in you, they have faith in something else. Yes, because faith is intrinsic to the soul, according to the laws of nature, to have faith. So there's faith, or there's faith. There's faith in the science, what the scientist says, what's their authority. You know, Einstein said, or somebody said, or professor, somebody or other said. And our authority is Krishna, and we'll settle. So faith is not a problem. Faith is not, doesn't make it wrong or invalid or something like that. Then comes reason. So then Prabhupada would say, okay, let's place faith aside and let's speak reason. Now he knows, Prabhupada knows, that tarka apratishta. You can't conclusively establish anything through logic and reason. So therefore, theology, like what Tamal Krishnamurti did when he went back to complete his undergraduate study, he did a series of papers purposefully on one theme, faith and reason, because that's a big, in Christian theology, it's a big issue. Theological issue. How much should faith be based upon reason? Should you unreasonably just place blind faith in something? Or should you measure the amount of faith you place in something because it's reasonable to do so? It goes back and forth, but his little book is all on that topic. So, faith is it. First part. Faith is something you cannot take away from existence because it's part of our existence. So where, this is intelligent, but where do you repose that faith? In what do you place your faith? Then comes this other, well, reasonable to place faith in something, but you know, what's reasonable for you may be unreasonable for me who's going to settle. So you can't take away that item. It's of the soul. Faith is going to be there. Then, all this discussion of
some person say, oh, this life is meaningless. Because all there is this fake thing floating around, and so really it's meaningless. And there were these discussions, Albert Camus, that life is meaningless. And he, one day, he was driving his car and said, life is meaningless, and he drove off the cliff. It's meaningful, life and death, so he just drove off the cliff. Yeah.
By accident?
Intentionally. He drove off the cliff, just so you know. It doesn't make any difference. Why maintain my life? It doesn't make any difference. But that, you know, that's a decision too. So when Prabhupada purposely took the devotees down these various paths, you might want to listen to those series of recorded morning walk conversations, because it's loaded. And Prabhupada doesn't go to complex. He stayed with very, very simple points. Very simple points. Like, you know, one of them that we've heard so many times, he would say so many times. What's the question of faith? You have a father. Everyone has a father. And that father had a father, and we must come from father, so the origin is father. That's inductive. And who? What fool is going to say otherwise? No, not from father for a monkey. Has anyone seen fathers come from your children? Monkeys bear children, human beings. Where's the evidence? Where's the evidence? Or here's the chemicals produce life. You say life comes from chemicals. Well, it takes millions of years. We say life comes from life. That's the evidence. That's not, you know, scripture says. It's our experience. Life comes from life. There's no experience of life coming from anything other than life. And you want us to believe that life comes from something other than life? Well, show us life comes from something other than life. No, we can't do that. And I'm supposed to accept that? I'm not a fool. That person's a fool. That person's an accept. So, like that, he would. Then there's some faith in my capacity to reason that says, I'll accept things that are this time immortal, always, and not accept something that's ever just some cheating rascal that has some theory that says life comes from something other than life. And children are produced by other than fathers.
How do you explain then the clone? I'm not a Balinese student, but I don't have much knowledge about that.
I don't either. Yeah. I don't even know, I don't even know what clone is, so I can't answer your question.
They have to fertilize.
They have to fertilize. They have to take from the cells. It's just like the rose pattern, wrapped it and then another.
Anything else? Yes.
It's a related question. In the lecture, you condemn science as modern and mechanistic, and in general, a lot of devotees and even Prabhupada condemns science as saying is descending and not it's ascending and not descending. One of the dilemmas I face in my day-to-day life is one of the purposes of Vedas is to teach people, or one of the things that Vedas impart is how to have a healthy life and how to defend yourself. There are extensive portions of how to kind of invoke missiles when you want to.
How do what?
Invoke missiles.
Weapons.
Nations?
Weapons.
Weapons.
Oh.
So it's actually, I'm not asking a frivolous question. It's actually
that's karma kanda section of the Vedas.
Yeah,
not the kanda section of the Vedas.
Yeah, it's not important. The most important thing is going back to Godhead. But at least on one side we are not encouraging people to. We are not telling people that, hey, all that you're doing is already there in Vedas, go look for it. We are guiding people in that fashion. At the same time, we are condemning people who are...
It's just, when the one is missing in front of the zeros, we just say zero, that's all. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
Put the one in front of the zero, then it's ten. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Real simple.
So we are condemning their general...
You've got a computer. It's a product of research and technology. I have one too. We're using them. So it's not the science and technology is not condemned except when the one is missing. And largely, the one is missing. The purpose for which these things are sciences applied is godless civilization. And promoting, just accelerating godless civilization.
In Varnashram Dharma, the job of a Brahmana is to functions as a doctor, and as a Kshatriya he also functions as how to defend yourself well, and that's a primary thing. For example, what Drona taught Arjuna. So with no Vedic knowledge being applied now, so they are taking that role, and Varnashram Dharma is not really a completely godless thing. Someone could still do that and still do that.
Varnashram can be godless and Varnashram can be God-centered. There's Asurk Varnashram and there is Daivi Varnashram.
Okay.
Don't get confused. The science of, like, you know, Duryodhana learned the same skill that Bhima learned.
Okay.
He was very good with the club. And Karna was very good with bowmanship, as was Arjuna.
Mm-hmm.
So the skill, the knowledge comes of Brahminical and Kshatriya capacities may come from the Vedas. But how is it applied? Is there a one in front of it? That's the concern.
So an extension to this is, so there are two approaches you could take in dealing with the material world. One is, as Krishna says, Krishna doesn't precisely say that, but Krishna says, if you are a Shrestha, then people will follow you. So one approach is you excel in, even in science and technology advancement as a devotee, be the best. And the other approach, as Lord Chaitanya Prabhupada says, is ajagar vritti. Use whatever is ayutta vairagya, use whatever is available, but don't deal with material world, deal with material world only as much as necessary. So what do you think is right for devotees in ISKCON in general?
The latter. And the exception is the exception.
Okay.
I'm saying that on the basis of my understanding of how Prabhupada engaged people. Some he encouraged to continue and pursue that the first path. And others, largely, it was not necessary. Okay. How he set up the whole Gurukul system, for example, repeatedly. Character, not, you know, pack them up with the academic stuff. Character. Yeah, some this, some that. Character. Or that long, one another example, discussion with in Bhaktivedanta Manor, where a mother came to
speak with Prabhupada about her son going to medical school. And the priest was there to like give her support, and Prabhupada said it's not necessary. You can just go to doctors. Well, doctors are important in society, yes. There's doctors. We go to doctors. Well, we go to doctors, so they're very important. This my son, he's so capable. And he didn't budge. And the priest, anyway, he didn't, in general. Then there's, you know, specific persons. He told certain persons. He told Sadaputta complete. He told the Vidra complete. Then he told them how to use it. So, that's it. That's an answer to your question.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry, can I go?
Yeah, sure.
Perhaps the last thing. So, even when there are not exceptions, for example, majority of a society are actually working in a working environment. So in that environment, should we try to be mediocre and just stay in the?
No. You don't try to be mediocre. You whatever it is that you do that for Krishna, and do it under guidance. Should I? Whatever. Should I take extra courses? Should I? One of the services that the employed devotees in the workplace can do is be an example to the other people in the workplace. This is an example of how to live your life in devotion to Krishna. And if you're a slouch in the workplace, they're not going to take it very seriously. But if you excel in the workplace, whoa. So,
okay.
Excel for Krishna's service, not, you know, the other reason, the other perks that people get into.
Mm-hmm.
And from that position, then I'll be able to speak the message of devotion and show, by example, the message of devotion. Because it's real.
Okay.
And so, regard and respect will vote to that person who has the quality of devotion and the component of, you know, what them looks like material success. Whereas the devotee, that's not the carrot.
Okay.
It's working for Krishna. That's their inspiration. It's a different energy. Material and spiritual energy. That's the challenge of people that have that situation. It's a challenge for everybody. Pick your challenge.
Yeah. So to summarize, what I seem to understand is, it is better to not get into dealing with material world, but if you have to deal with that, just set a good example.
There's, what's the word? There's a, according to the Jai Jagannath, you know Jai Jagannath, he gets really brahmachari-like with the definition, the translation of the word anasaktashya yattaham, according to something like specificity. He wants to know what does that mean. It's the regular question. As is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's appropriate for one may be appropriate, inappropriate for another. And even for one circumstance may be appropriate, another circumstance may not be appropriate. So, where do you put the fulcrum? Where's that sliding scale? Needs guidance. But according to time, place, circumstance, and the individual, this may be appropriate, and another time not appropriate.
So the
definition that you gave isn't exactly what Yukta Vairagya says.
Yes.
A complete form of detachment.
Yeah. So essentially it's chapter 5. I mean, you have to be renounced even when you're doing the work, but the way you have to be renounced when you're doing work is, you know,
that's the art of work.
Yeah. Okay.
Do it for Krishna. And what that may mean for one may mean something different for another.
Yeah.
I could ask you to go create the universe.
That's very much.
Yeah.
There's a verse, instruction. We should follow our own. It's better to perform your own work imperfectly than perform someone else's perfectly.
Yeah.
So, how do we know? It's maybe along his line of question. What is our work? Is it because anyway?
There's different ways of measuring. One is from scripture. There's from scripture. That's like the textbook. And then there's introspection. And then there's qualified brahmanas who can evaluate. So, you know, we need different reference points to get it right. What is one's work? What is one's prescribed duty? So, according to one's nature, chatur-varna-maya-shristam-guna, karma-vibhavisha. Krishna says he created according to those two factors. Okay, what's my guna, what's my karma? So, you can, through evaluation, you can see, this is my guna. That's subjective. Objective. My dear five brahmanas, you know me. Can you give your evaluation? Consistently under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master. So that may or may not mean one's Diksha Guru, but someone that's qualified and can, Shishya Stevam Shadimam from Prapana, someone that I can hear from, take guidance from. Just, a little pragmatic thing. This is like, something that he says that there are different evaluators that he uses. One is Prabhupada's teachings, and to the best of his capacity, Prabhupada's teachings, his own introspection and evaluation from those who he, respects and, literally take guidance from. And yet the combination of those tells him what he should do. That's the work. That's, very consistently over time. He does like that. Some inspiration, and then he goes through that evaluation process. Introspection, study carefully, praying, Prabhupada's books, what's the practice applied to me, and then guidance from those who need something. Oh, same, very similar, just a practical example of something simple. Anything else? We're an hour and 37 minutes into our class. Go ahead.
This is again connected to the workplace daily activity. So in the daily workplace, like sometimes I feel like we are isolated to the rest of the team. Sometimes, like because of I invite for the lunch and we are not able to go with them. And only one person is leaving, that is me, and the rest of the team is going all together. But if I go, that is a different situation.
Yes, it is.
So, those things like, is it okay to strictly follow that or?
I suggest you look at Bhakti Loka, written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It's a description of the six and the six. Six that destroy, six that nurture bhakti. And he gives very specific advice for householders on things like this. Because he's a householder. And he's an acharya, so he makes distinction between those that are renounced, those that are householders. These are principles that can guide your life. Just stick by principles. what he said, just a quick one, is when for unwholesome association, he says, for one who's a householder and has to move in circles where his job is, being cordial, and he gives, you know, like, how are you today? How is your family? That's not unwholesome association, it's just being cordial. But the other kind is unwholesome. It can destroy bhakti. So, in one sense it's a fine line, and in another sense, you know, one individual, another individual may have a greater digestion capacity. But to be on the cautious edge, specifically that I'm not taking on unwholesome association, because when informal sessions like that arise, all kinds of topics come up that are unwholesome. And then, you know, you're uncomfortable. You know, it's all over the map, as you know. Politics and, you know, their private life and sports and, you know, vacations and how they spend their money and investing and all of the map.
That is amazing. Yeah.
So, and it's not nurturing bhakti. So you're there, you know, thinking, you know, where's the let's see, let me think of a good reason why I can leave now. And so it's unwholesome. It's toxic. So what to do? Because you're part of the team. It's challenging. So some amount of, but Bhakti no toxic, the simple principle is some amount of social is not toxic. And more than that is unwholesome, it gets more toxic. He doesn't use toxic language. It can destroy bhakti. So you want to protect your bhakti people first and foremost. At the same time, not be, you know, a non-member of team. There are different ways of thinking for different individuals, methods of work. I'm going to end just because we've been going on for so long. Thank you all for being tolerant and patient. Thank you.